From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We all know what a farm looks like. Red barn, silo, fields of waving corn, tractors, combines, cows. Now, picture a busy city street, four lanes of traffic, buses, garbage trucks, police sirens. Might not look like it, but this too is a farm.
These are some broccoli and Brussels sprouts, and I'm looking for some collards. We're on the far north side of Milwaukee, about 15 minutes from downtown. It used to be pretty much all-white neighborhood. That's gone through transition over the years, so it's a pretty mixed neighborhood. But five blocks away is the largest housing project in Milwaukee.
Okay, this is it.
Okay, we're in greenhouse number one, and we use this greenhouse for a number of things. Jerry here is seeding sprouts, sunflower sprouts. That'll be ready a week from now. These are worm bins where we have 40,000 pounds of compost with worms in them, and the worms I'll eat through this compost and produce worm casting. I love farming. You know, I like to see things grow. I like to get my food to people. We're going to be over 200 acres this year, and we're hoping to have over 100 acres of hoop houses up to be able to grow year-round. That's what really turns me on, the challenge of being able, you know, to really quantify that this can be done.
You need plants?
We could use some seedlings, absolutely.
Okay, all right. Let's move it in.
MacArthur genius Will Allen shows us around his landmark inner-city farm today. Urban farming has come a long way from the community garden and backyard chicken coop. How far could it go? About up. The vertical farm is the brainchild of microbiologist Dixon Depommier. And Strange Champs wanted to know more.
I want to start by asking you to share your vision for the vertical farm. So
sure.
Imagine that we're standing together on a street corner in a busy city, Seattle maybe, or Chicago, and up ahead we see the world's first vertical farm. What does it look like?
Well, first of all, the building will have to be absolutely, totally transparent. Perhaps it's 5 to 10 stories tall and maybe a half of a city block in footprint. Inside, you'll see people dressed in uniforms. I presume these are going to be the kind of uniforms that you might find electronics workers wearing. It's a clean environment, in other words, and they're tending plants. And these plants are growing hydroponically. And you've got tomatoes and green beans and cucumbers and pumpkins. And you might even have a few floors devoted to things like wheat or barley.
Is it going to be like broccoli on the second floor and legumes on the 10th?
Absolutely. You know, you can just hear the elevator doorman saying, you know, corn, squash.
How many people could a vertical farm like this feed?
Well, that's a good question. It depends on how big you want to build it. I gave an exercise to my class while I was still teaching. I'm now retired, but one of the exercises that I started with was you got to feed 50,000 people. How big a farm do we need? I took all the constraints off, like expense and where you're going to put it in the city and things like this, just as a think piece. And they came up with a building that was about 30 stories tall, and it occupied one square New York City block, which is a lot. It would be the biggest building in the world, basically. But that building, with the crops that have already been identified by NASA as viable crops that you could grow anywhere and feed astronauts for the rest of their natural lives, so you could feed 50,000 people a year like that with that size building. So about 130 of these buildings, you could feed the entire city of New York.
That's sort of astonishing.
It is. It actually is.
Now, I can see lots of advantages to this system. For instance, there would be no need to worry about a sudden ice storm at the wrong season or a rainy summer wrecking the crops because it's all indoors and climate controlled.
And you get continuous crop production, too. So let's take a crop that everybody's familiar with, corn. You plant it sometime in May and you harvest it sometime in August, and that's it. That's all you get. Indoors, because the conditions are constant and you're doing this hydroponically, you can get a crop of corn every 8 weeks. So if you divide 8 weeks into 52, you can see how many different crops of corn you can have over a year's period, which means, of course, that if you did it that way rather than outdoors, you wouldn't need that cornfield any longer, and you could return it to what it used to be before it was a cornfield. That's usually a hardwood forest in most of the East.
But why do this? We have farm fields.
Well, this is very true. I mean, we have farm fields in this country. In fact, we have lots of them. But if you go to other parts of the world, and I would take you on another trip then to India or to China or to Southeast Asia or to Australia or to any of the Scandinavian countries or to the American Southwest, in those places that I've just described, farming is either failing because of some weather conditions that have been affected by climate change, like the monsoons, for instance, or they've never had rain. In the case of Australia, I mean, that poor country catches on fire every summer. So farming indoors makes the most sense in those cases.
This doesn't seem like the ultimate in factory farming, though, to have a gigantic glass skyscraper filled with crops tended by people in lab coats.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm proposing. I'm not against factory farming as long as it's for a good purpose.
Well, continuing with our thought experiment, then imagine that we're well into the age of vertical farming and mm-hmm. we're flying in an airplane over the continental U.S.
Right.
We're over Kansas or Missouri or Iowa. Yeah, instead of all those cornfields, what is there?
Well, let's start in New York City. I'd like to take you from there first, because if you go from New York to the Mississippi River, if you could have flown in the 1600s, the only thing you would have ever seen is hardwood forest from start to finish. And in fact, somebody once wrote that a squirrel living in Boston in the 1600s and wanting to visit their cousins in St. Louis would never have to leave the ground. They could just jump from tree to tree all the way through. So the return of a large tracts of land to forest would suck up a lot of carbon from the atmosphere, and we know that that's absolutely essential if we're going to do something about climate change, regardless of whether the listener thinks that the human species is responsible or partially responsible or not even responsible for climate change. The fact is that with all that CO2 sitting in the atmosphere, and it's a lot more now than it was, it has to go someplace. And the someplace that I would like to see it go is back into the trees where it used to be before we cut them down in favor of farmland.
What about taste? Because, right. I mean, so much of the taste of our food comes from the land, from the soil, the minerals, the varied weather patterns. I mean, anybody who's had a hydroponically grown tomato knows that there's just, it's not the same as a tomato grown in dirt on somebody's farm.
I totally agree with you that soil-grown produce has a unique signature. And depending on where you are throughout the country, that signature varies. And it's called terroir. I believe the term for that is terroir. I would ask you to instead consider being isolated in the countryside of Haiti right now, or in Darfur, or in Niger, or in places that are challenged. Just put food on the table. It doesn't matter what it tastes like as long as it's healthy. And then bring up that concept of terroir again. It disappears entirely, of course, and all you're concerned about is the nutritional status of those poor people. I envision vertical farming not to substitute for these wonderful locally grown crops of plants that we eat seasonally, but rather to serve as a mechanism for ensuring that throughout the world, 6.8 billion people, regardless of where they live, can eat and have 1,500 calories of food that's safe and safe to drink water. And the vertical farm will supply that if it's carried out properly.
The vertical farm idea is catching on and has fired a lot of people's imaginations. And I noticed you've got a blurb on the cover of your book from Sting. Is this more than just a dream? Is it actually going to happen?
Well, in fact, I think I can promise you that it's going to happen even if I were to somehow disappear tomorrow. It's out of my control at this point. I can assure you from the email that I get all the time from business people, from investors, from Forbes magazine, for instance, and The Economist, and the countries of the Arab Emirates are extremely interested in making this happen because, A, the expense of this is not the issue. It's whether or not they can actually put their own food on their own table. Right now, about 90% of their food comes from other places, and they're more interested in food security than they are in the expense of the food itself. Producing food locally, indoors, hydroponically, year-long, in places like Qatar and Abu Dhabi and Dubai will revolutionize the way those countries behave in terms of their food supplies. So they're going to do it. I think by next year I should be able to show you one.
Dixon DePommier is a microbiologist and the author of The Vertical Farm.
When the farmer comes to town with a wagon broken down, the farmer is the one who feeds us all. If you only look and see, I think you will agree that the farmer is the one who feeds us all. The farmer is the one, farmer is the one, lives on credit till the fall. Every woman, child, and man, I think will understand that the farmer is the one who feeds us all.
One of the first cities in the U.S. to build a vertical farm might be Milwaukee. That's where urban farming pioneer Will Allen is raising money for a farm that will rise 5 stories tall. Allen is the former pro basketball player and MacArthur genius who built one of the nation's most famous inner-city farms. It's called Growing Power, and its downtown Milwaukee home base includes 6 greenhouses, 7 hoop houses, 14 beehives, a worm farm, and a lot of fish.
Yeah, this is greenhouse number 2, and this is a 10,000-gallon fish system with 10,000 tilapia in it. This is called aquaponics. It's a symbiotic relationship between the fish and the plants.
What kind of fish are those?
Black paku. They're related to piranha. These get up to 60 pounds. They have teeth like humans. We sell them to restaurants, and people come here and purchase fish from our retail store up front. We eat good around here. See, look at the mouth on that one. It just opened its mouth. See the teeth? I wouldn't put my fingers in there. And a lot of people said, oh, you can't do this. And that kind of turns me on. Because being a former athlete, I like challenges. I like for somebody to say, I can't do something that really stirs my blood. And I'm going to prove that I can do it. I don't care how long it takes me, you know, but I'm gonna be working at it every day.
When Will Allen bought his first 2 acres in downtown Milwaukee, the area was a food desert with nothing but convenience stores and fast food chains nearby. Today, Growing Power produces enough vegetables and fish to feed thousands of people and is a center for jobs and training. Allen tells N. Strainchamps that healthy food and social justice go hand in hand.
One of the declarations I made to the city of Milwaukee is I would hire youth from the community, having grown up on a farm myself, and the things that you can just learn that all kids used to back in the day. Many kids grew up on farms and so forth. So kids were kind of missing that, not knowing really where their food came from. I helped a youth group and nobody would help. They wanted to grow an organic garden, and I gave them the space. And the kids were really the key in terms of engaging the community, because they would take what I was teaching them back home and really demand from their parents to eat healthier and grow some of the things that they were eating here. Like I gave kids salad mix who had never had anything but head lettuce, and all of a sudden they're eating these 12 different mixed salad greens, and he just wanted more and more. And that was really a sign that their bodies really needed this nutrient.
It also strikes me that there's another piece to this story, a historical piece that also has to do with race. I remember reading in your book, you said at one time you thought you must be the only black farmer in Wisconsin. What happened that drove African Americans away from the land?
Well, of course, farming is one of the toughest things you can do, and many African-American folks after the Civil War went into sharecropping. Like my father was a sharecropper. You know, one day he just dropped his plow and mule and headed north, and that's what happened to many African-Americans that were involved in agriculture, over 300,000 back in those days in the 30s and 40s. Now we're down to 18,000 African-American farmers in this country, which is just a drop in the bucket. But that's starting to increase now. I don't hear what I heard 15, 20 years ago when I would go into African-American communities and they say, Will, why are you doing the slaves work? I don't hear that anymore. So more people of color are getting involved, and more immigrants who lost their land. And there's a number of reasons. And one reason is the health our health of our communities have deteriorated to the point where we have childhood obesity, we have diabetes, we have heart disease, high blood pressure, and people are becoming much more educated around that issue.
How does that then connect with the prevalence of food deserts in our inner cities, these areas where it's really hard to find fresh produce of any kind, let alone local fresh produce?
Well, what happened 20 years ago, many of the retail grocery stores that were anchored in low-income communities pulled out for whatever reasons.
I mean, did they just think, oh, poor people don't want fresh vegetables?
No, I think it had a lot to do with, first of all, those stores were poorly run. They put their worst managers in those stores. They brought in the worst food into those stores. So a lot of it had to do with the racism and how they operated the stores. And, of course, there's more security needed because of, you know, you're in a poor community where there's a lot more crime and so forth. So a lot of stores moved out of those communities, even though there was money to be made. If stores operated properly, they could make a lot of money in those areas. So we're starting to see stores come back in. But we can't wait for that. We have to be proactive. And the easiest and most efficient and the thing that makes sense is grow food in your backyard. You grow a percentage of your food in your backyard, a side yard, or on your balcony, or wherever.
What's the personal satisfaction for you? I mean, what keeps you going? You've been doing this a long time, and it was your second career to begin with.
I think the thing that drives me is I really like farming. I love farming. You know, I like to see things grow. I like to get my food to people. And that's kind of the driving force, is to get healthy food to folks, to be able to get food to everybody, not just to one segment of our community. Because people like to pigeonhole you and say, oh, you're just growing food for really poor people. No, we're growing the same food for everybody. Everybody gets our food, regardless of your economic status, because it's really all about food access. So that's what really turns me on, the challenge of being able to prove and quantify that this can be done.
Is that the main thing that's kind of the main challenge, is getting us past believing that this can't be done, that it's just, this is the system we have and the system we're stuck with?
Yeah, and part of what I try to do is inspire people by having this concrete example. You can't just talk about it. So that kind of turns me on, the fact that this is really difficult to do. And if people see it, that it's, somebody's doing it, then they're ready to jump on board. They might not be ready to just say, oh, I'm going to want to do what Will does, you know. But if I prove that it can be done and you can make a living doing it, as I travel the country and talk to colleges, many of these young people want to do this work. They don't want to follow their parents' footsteps into corporate America. They've seen how unhappy and how corporate America has thrown people to the sidelines and so forth. And so they want to do something to give back to their community. You know, and I have a lot of faith in this next generation, and I have a lot of faith in that people of color are now coming back into, and that pleases me to see that happen as well.
Will Allen is the founder and CEO of Growing Power, a farm and community development center in Milwaukee. He won a MacArthur Genius Award in 2008 and is one of Time's 100 most influential people in the world. You can read more about his work in his book, The Good Food Revolution. We head to France next, where school lunch is a four-course meal. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In America, if you want to start an argument, ask a group of parents what they think of their school's lunch program. Even Congress argues about school lunch. Things are different in France, where gastronomie, the appreciation of good food, is at the center of public education.
University of British Columbia professor Karen LeBillon discovered this firsthand when she moved to France with her husband and two young daughters. Her first surprise? French kids eat everything. Steve Paulson, who has two picky eaters of his own at home, was a bit skeptical.
Do French kids really eat everything?
As surprising as that might sound, they actually do. When our family moved to France, I couldn't quite believe my eyes. Young children eating things like mussels and beets and celeriac and leeks, and the list went on and on. And the amazing thing was they ate all of this stuff happily.
So the parent was not hovering over their shoulder, saying, eat or else.
No. So the remarkable lack of whining, coercion, and family food fights was the thing I really found perplexing, because my daughters, quite young at the time, were your typical North American children. They were on the beige food diet, so pasta, crackers, Cheerios, Goldfish crackers, those sorts of things. And to get them to eat anything else was a real struggle, and often made dinner very unpleasant. And I didn't see any of this going on around us in France, so I was very intrigued.
So how old were your daughters when you first arrived in France?
They were then 4, just about to turn 5, and a toddler. So quite young, but old enough to have pretty fixed eating habits. So at first, they were quite resistant to the notion of eating the foods that were proffered to them by my mother-in-law and also at school, because in France, children don't bring lunches from home. So a huge hurdle we had to cross was actually getting my children to eat like the little French kids at preschool and at kindergarten.
And how did you do that?
Well, I didn't have to do much at first, because I was convinced, of course, that they couldn't eat this way. So I promptly told their teachers, this won't work. I want to bring a packed lunch from home. Now, keep in mind, the French believe that learning does not stop in the lunchroom. In fact, they teach children about food in the classroom with curriculum and at lunchtime, where children will have a freshly cooked 3 or 4 course hot lunch every day.
A 3 or 4 course school lunch.
Yes. And I know I laughed as well. But so, and they post the menus on the school door because, of course, the parents want to know what their children have been eating. So I'm confronted with these menus, can't believe my children will eat them, tell the teachers this, and am confronted with an astounding response. I'm politely but firmly told, Madame, it is our job to teach your children to eat well, and we will do so.
So give me some sample school lunches that your own kids ate.
Sure. So typically, every meal starts with a vegetable starter first course. It might be grated carrot salad, beet salad, green leafy salad. It's always vegetables. And this is then followed by a hot main course with a vegetable side. Usually it's a fish or a meat dish, everything from roast guinea fowl to, for older kids, steak. On we go then to the third course, which is cheese with baguette. And sometimes that's stinky French cheese. It's not always the equivalent of cheddar. Dessert is the fourth course, and that will be usually fresh fruit. But because this is France and food is fun and food is about moderation, not deprivation, one day out of 5, the kids will get a sweet treat. So those lunches are meant to be the main meal of the day. They're 40 to 50% of kids' caloric intake. And by Ministry of Education regulations, they get at least 30 minutes to eat and then an hour to play.
And did your kids adjust?
After about 2 or 3 months, with the polite encouragement of their peers, because there's a lot of positive peer pressure in French schools. So my little 4-year-old daughter, now she's 4, is in kindergarten, and she'll come home and say, well, my friends told me you just have to taste it. They always have to taste it, because they're teaching kids to eat much as we would teach them to read. It's a skill that you acquire through practice and persistence.
Well, it also sounds expensive to put on these school lunches, and I assume that you have to have skilled chefs to prepare this food.
That's what's quite astounding. So the average cost of these meals is about $3, and there is a system of cross-subsidies between parents. So in Paris, these lovely 4-course meals that every child has access to, because there are no vending machines in schools, no fast food on the premises, and children cannot bring lunches from home unless they have medically certified allergies. So everyone is in the canteen eating this lunch. And the average cost is $3. The wealthiest parents pay up to $7 per meal, and the lowest income parents pay 20 cents per meal.
What about snacks? Do French kids come home from school and dive into the cupboard?
The French attitude to snacking is fairly astounding, and I couldn't believe it when we arrived. French children traditionally do not snack, and this starts quite young. At the age of 8 or 9 months, they're eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then they have one sanctioned afternoon snack called the goûter, which is actually quite substantial. It's like a mini meal. In between, there is no snacking, no random snacking, no rummaging in cupboards, no, you know, trailing boxes or bags of Cheerios and crackers around it. So this means that French children never learn to snack randomly and repeatedly, as we teach our children to do in North America. So the average number of times a North American child snacks per day is 3, and 1 in 5 North American kids snacks 5 times per day. Some nutritionists argue that this is one of the major contributors to the rise in rates of overweight and obesity.
Of course, one of the mysteries about France that you hear about all the time, the so-called French paradox, is that the French eat all of this rich food, and they are thinner than Americans on average. Is it because they don't snack?
The French believe that the healthy eating routines they set up, where there is no snacking, are a major factor in preventing the rise in rates of obesity and overweight. And in fact, when rates of child obesity started to rise about a decade ago, they acted quite decisively to make sure that children were not snacking. Vending machines had crept into schools. There was more fast food consumption than there had been previously, and more sort of fast foods creeping into school cafeterias. So the French government banned those and also tightened up school lunch regulations. In addition, TV ads for snack foods on French television now carry a health warning, a lot like cigarette packs here at home. It says snacking in between meals is bad for your health. So they had a public health campaign, and the rates of overweight and obese children actually stagnated and slightly declined. So they basically nipped it in the bud. And this is a great example for us, because France is not a culture that is impervious to all of these cultural influences that we're facing. You know, increased commuting times, two working parents, long days, the easy availability of prepackaged and highly processed foods. They have all of those things. They actually have the highest rate of McDonald's per capita in Europe. But they've managed to sustain these healthy eating routines, and thus they are an outlier in terms of rates of child obesity and overweight, even within Europe. The UK, Spain, Italy, they're looking a lot like us.
Now, you clearly have been won over by the French approach to food, and it does raise the question of how much this can be translated to the United States, which has a very different culture, which resists, for instance, a heavy government hand. I mean, I don't know how, you know, this kind of school lunch policy would go over in the U.S. Can this be translated into American culture?
The French actually have a lot less government involvement in school food than we do, in the sense that communities are entirely responsible for funding and organizing school meals. There is no equivalent of the National School Lunch Program. So communities are left to their own devices. And the French approach is thus an example of how wonderful school food can be if communities are allowed to act. A lot more of it is locally sourced. Parents are on school committees that organize the menus, and there's a great sense of investment. And I think there's a great appetite here, too, for parents and communities to get more involved in school food. And we might actually take a chapter out of the French book and think about reform to the National School Lunch Program to allow a lot more community action. That's what the French could teach us, surprisingly.
If you were to offer some advice to the people who are listening to us right now, maybe 2 or 3 little things that families can do, just leaving aside for a moment what schools might do, what would be the first few things that you would advise?
The first thing is that as a family, you can set goals about learning to eat lots of variety, and that younger children have extremely adventurous taste buds, and that older children, in spite of seeming skeptical, can easily be brought into the family food experiment. So there's a recipe in the book, for example, for spinach puree. I have yet to serve this to a child who didn't like it. I think a lot of the issue with children's poor eating habits actually arises from parental disbelief that children can eat well. A second important point, no snacking. I mean, when we cut out snacking, I found that was the turning point for us as a family because the children were more hungry at mealtimes and they actually were then able to concentrate on eating the nutritious food we provided. So, in fact, many people who have read the book have decided to follow this as a strategy and reported pretty amazing results. It's easier to cut out snacking than you think. Limit your children to one snack a day. And then concentrate on fun, interesting, pleasant social meal times at which discovering new food together is an adventure, not a chore. And I think families will see some pretty amazing results.
Karen LeBillon is the author of French Kids Eat Everything. If you want to take her spinach challenge, the recipe's on our website at ttbook.org. Bon appetit!
Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to my kitchen. I'm going to do some deviled eggs today. That's stuffed, hard-boiled eggs. I just love them. Now, if you're going to do a whole lot...
Everybody knows Julia Child, the French chef on PBS for many years. The tall woman with a funny, friendly voice who made you think you might actually enjoy cooking. The woman many don't know is Julia McWilliams, who became Julia Child only after her work in espionage during World War II. Biographer Janet Conant picks up her story in the book A Covert Affair, Julia and Paul Child in the OSS. She says America's reaction to the couple's heroic service wasn't what you'd expect.
I meant it to be a shock. I wanted it to be as hair-raising and surprising and disturbing for the reader as it must have been for them in 1955 when they got that telegram summoning Paul Child to Washington, only to discover that he was going to be subjected to a full loyalty review, as it was called in those days. I mean, it was shocking for them.
And yet we all know of those days. We've forgotten about them in some ways, but we know what the McCarthy era and the politics of fear was all about. But it raises the question again, why would Paul Child even be of concern to them?
Well, Paul Child had served in the OSS. He'd had quite an important job in the OSS. He'd built war rooms for the Allied generals, and he'd traveled all over the Southeast Asia theater. And what happened after the war is that many of our leading State Department advisors and OSS intelligence advisors that had served in China were being hauled in front of Senate committees and being accused of being soft on communism. And it was very sad because for Paul and Julia, you know, they had been very patriotic. They had served with the OSS during the war. They had all of these colleagues that had served during the war, and they were looking around. You know, post-war, Paul was working for the State Department in Paris, and then in Germany, he was in a propaganda field. And he's looking at his colleagues to the left and right, and they're being persecuted, dragged before the courts. They're having their reputations ruined. A lot of them had, like, promotions canceled or were being sent to Siberia. So Paul and Julia were really seeing their friends persecuted and were more and more anxious about Paul Child's own career in the State Department because he was quite left of center politically and had served in China.
And of course, this is the point at which he discovered who they were really after, his friend Jane Foster, her friend Jane Foster. I mean, that's really the focus around which all of this whirls, isn't it? She was something else.
She was, you know, funny. She was kind of the mirror image of Julia. Like Julia, she was from a wealthy, conservative California family, and she had joined the OSS. She didn't need to work like Julia didn't have to work. She joined out of a sense of adventure and to do her duty. But she was a very outspoken, irreverent character, very mischievous, very sexually adventurous. She had lots of affairs and lovers, and she was quite a brilliant woman, spoke a number of languages. And during the war, for the OSS, she did quite dangerous assignments behind enemy lines. But after the war, she was very, very critical of U.S. policy in Southeast Asia. She felt we had broken Roosevelt's sort of New Deal era promise to support liberty in these countries, which is very critical. And then in the 50s, she became suspected of being a Russian spy, and there was a huge, massive FBI investigation into her and all of her friends. And Julia and Paul, you know, had not only known her from Washington before the war, but were great friends of hers in Paris after the war when Julia was starting her cooking and giving a lot of dinner parties. Jane was always a favorite guest. So what happened is that close association with the Childs brought Paul into this massive FBI investigation into Russian spying, and he just got grilled.
Yeah. You talk about how similar Jane and Julia were, but they were also very different from each other. Julia was more than 6 feet tall and not sexually adventurous. Jane Foster was much more adventurous. And of course, we look at Julia and Paul Child as a couple who represent the ideal of a long-lasting marriage. There was no indication that that was going to happen when they first met, was there?
No, I think I love it for that reason. It's the opposite of Match.com. These were people that had nothing in common. And in fact, they had so little in common that even though Julia was smitten with Paul, he was a decade older, a head shorter, just really the unlikeliest person for her. He was really not impressed with her. He really thought she was from a sort of meat and potatoes background. He had a kind of horror of her father's right-wing politics. You know, he was partly raised in France. He spoke impeccable French. He loved fine food. He loved literature. He liked to talk politics, you know, in that passionate way that the French do where you argue over everything. And Julia just was completely uninformed, inexperienced. She'd never been further outside the United States than Tijuana. He just thought she was a very sheltered, sort of in many ways uninteresting girl. And he would rave in his letters to his twin brother about all of these fascinating, sophisticated sort of Mata Haris that the OSS had working as spies. And then he would say, oh, and then there's this Julia Child. Well, she's a good kid. It took him a long, long, long time to see that there was something more to Julia than met the eye.
Well, he clearly did. I mean, when he met her, and you're very clear about it, he said he liked her, but not that way. And it was later in the war that they actually began to see each other in a different light, right?
Well, what happened is they spent a year together in Ceylon, and really he did not pay a lot of attention to her, but they were together a lot. But then when they were transferred to China, they were in a very remote, primitive outpost in Kunming by the end of the war. That was a very small unit, and I think they were then, you know, together three meals a day, really very close, under very difficult, sometimes dangerous conditions. It was an intimate friendship, which by all accounts in the diaries probably ended up in bed with various victory celebrations there at the end. But by the end of the war, Julia really said that she would like to marry him. And he demurred and said, I think we need to take a good long look at each other in civilian clothes and really see if we have anything in common.
Well, that
and
makes so sense, doesn't it?
Because, yes, it does.
Because there's
wise.
so much emotional tension thrown into it in the situation they were in.
Yes, and I think he was aware that, you know, those booze-fueled victory parties, the jubilation of peace, the emotional sort of desolation of leaving all their friends and being catapulted back into civilian life where they really didn't know what they were going home to or their lives or their careers or their futures. I mean, what's interesting then is over the next 9 months, she's in Pasadena and he's in Washington. Their correspondence is absolutely charming. These letters of love, sort of like tender shoots, little phrases at first and then very passionate at the end. And it's just lovely to see.
You know, what's delightful about it in a way, again, is the contrast with what's to come and a contrast with Jane Foster, because she was this terribly sophisticated woman who had passions about politics. Paul and Julia, much, much less so. But when you look at the long future stretching out, they are the ones who formed a lasting relationship. They are the ones who came through all of this with something to celebrate. She, well, not really.
Not really. All the things that made her so vivid and glamorous and seemingly fabulous during the war. I mean, she was really somebody that Paul and Julia both admired and looked up to. She really came undone in the peacetime. I think she just made a lot of careless, unwise decisions in a dangerous climate in the 1950s, and it just brought disaster down on her head and the heads of all of her closest friends.
Is there any chance she was a traitor to the country?
I present all of the evidence, you know, in her massive FBI file of something like 650,000 pages in totality. I mean, they followed her for years and years. I personally think that she liked to be with these radicals, and she thought radical poets and artists and painters were cool. And I think that she got in with bad company. In the end, whether she actually did them some favors or whether they used her, it's very, very hard to tell.
But no matter what she was, it presented a moral dilemma for Paul and Julia. They had to decide how to balance loyalty to country and loyalty to friend.
And the evidence was just mounting and mounting against her, and she got more and more trouble, and her passport was confiscated, and she was dragged through all these hearings. And Julia and Paul knew this. She wrote them very long letters, harrowing letters, and they knew all this. And what's really impressive is that they made a very difficult choice, but they really decided that they would never be able to live with themselves if they did not stick by their friends, if they didn't remain loyal. And that was the choice they made. It was really an unusual choice. It was a very difficult time to do that. A lot of people just kept their heads down and looked the other way. And Julia and Paul were very brave and behaved with enormous honor. And I wanted people to see that because it's a fascinating study in friendship and in real character.
Janet Conant is the author of A Covert Affair, Julia and Paul Child in the OSS. We're talking about food and politics in this hour. Coming up, the most fought over food in the world, bread. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It's funny how often food and politics get mixed up together. Aaron Bobrow-Strain teaches about food and politics, specifically about the global food system at Whitman College. When he decided to write a history of white bread, the iconic puffy white store-bought loaf, he knew it might get a little controversial. He tells N. Strainchamps he had no idea just how loaded the subject would get.
I started off, it was just a book about bread. I'm kind of an amateur baking geek, and I really wanted to write a book about bread. You know, I'm one of those stereotypical backyard chicken raising, cheese making. You know, I worked on a humane, sustainable cattle ranch that I'm part owner of, and I really like to pickle things. I really do think that, you know, the industrial food system is broken in many ways, and we need to fix it. And I looked around, and there's all these books out there that are telling us in great detail how bad our food is, and then offering some kind of fairly simplistic solutions that are basically, you know, change your diet, change the world. And it felt a little unsatisfying. And what I really thought was, like, how have groups done this in the past, right? How have people tried to change America's food system in the past? What have they succeeded at? What have they failed at? And it turns out that industrial white bread is a fun way to get at that because it's our most fought over food.
It's always been really important to us, but you're suggesting that bread has always been political. So if we look back at the 20s or the 30s, for instance, bread became kind of a metaphor for questions about race, citizenship, immigration even. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, we see this, say, from the 1880s into the 1920s, middle-class, native-born Americans go through, you know, what we could maybe call a moral panic about the cleanliness of bread. newspaper headlines scream out, "Dangerous bakeries threaten the city," or "Germs lurk in your bread," and even good old mother's bread gets condemned by many scientific experts as being a potential biohazard. And it's very strange to me because I can't find any evidence that bread was actually making people sick.
So why was everybody so worried about the uncleanliness of bread?
Exactly. So when I start to go through the piles of testimonies and hearing transcripts about the quote-unquote bread problem, what I realize is that food fears about bread, cleanliness, had become inseparable from racial fears about the new, supposedly dirty, scary, threatening immigrants who were sweating away in those small bakeries and touching the bread with their hands. So in this moment where bread from local bakeries is seen as kind of scary and dark and dank and threatening, gleaming white bread coming out of these shining white factories full of stainless steel surfaces provides a kind of reassuring sense of safety for people. And this was underlying anxiety. This wasn't necessarily generated by the industrial baking sector, but they certainly benefited from it. And they start to capitalize on it. They advertise the new industrial white bread as untouched by human hands. That's the big slogan. And it was very clear that the human hands they were referring to were these supposedly scary, dirty immigrants.
Was it really clear? I mean, how do you see that connection getting made between immigrants and bread and unsanitary?
There's this great moment in a hearing that takes place in New York in the 19-teens where commissioners are interviewing witness after witness after witness, and all the witnesses are testifying about how horrific the conditions are for immigrant bakers. They were working 18-hour days. They were working in these dark, unventilated, overheated basement bakeries. They had tuberculosis because the air quality was so bad. But the commissioners reframe it as a question of how do we protect the consumer from these bad immigrant bakers. And there's this moment where the one commissioner is asking the guys, do you think that these bakers could be taught to have clean habits? The witness says, well, yes, I do think that. And the commissioner says something like, no, not really. These people are inherently unclean. And the other guy says, well, no, I think they could be reformed. And I realized at that moment they were not talking about bread anymore. They were talking about the nature of immigration and the nature of new immigrants.
And citizenship, right?
Right. And I think that gets at a central point of the book, is that our fears and our anxieties, even our desires and hopes about food, are often really not about food. They're about much bigger social questions.
How do you see that right now in debates about food and in particular about bread?
I think that we're in an interesting moment right now where a lot of our anxieties and aspirations and desires around food and bread in particular deal with notions of class. Industrial white bread has gone from being an icon of progress and responsible parenting, even national strength and patriotism, to being an emblem of poverty, ill health, and poor choices. And in that shift, what we've seen is a kind of segmentation of the bread market along class lines. Industrial white bread has become synonymous with white trash. Mm-hmm. And I think it is this shift between the counterculture and something that happens in the 70s and 80s, right? In the 60s, the counterculture takes up industrial white bread as everything that's wrong with America, right? It's bland, it's chemical, it's corporate. There's the slogan, "Don't eat white, eat right." Right?
There's this great quotation, Diana Vreeland said, people who eat white bread have no dreams.
Right. So it's already a kind of a moralizing force there. But it isn't just about health, right? Beatrice Thrum Hunter, who's an influential Whole Foods advocate at that moment, talks about how baking your own whole wheat bread is an act of revolt against the mechanization of life, an act of social revolt. So to eat non-white bread was to be part of a great collective social change. By the Reagan years, that sense of collective rebellion gets folded into a kind of individualistic, consumer-driven self-actualization movement, right? Where, for better or for worse, the whole wheat bread is really not about creating larger social change. It's about improving oneself, being individually more healthy, better looking, more successful.
Isn't the subtext here that all of these food reform movements, those in the past and then by extension those in the present right now, are all misguided because to a certain extent we're not really talking about food. We're talking about these other underlying social issues.
Exactly. The real lesson here is that food movements have focused too much on trying to change individual food choices. And I know that kind of sounds a little counterintuitive, right? Because shouldn't food movements try to change our food choices?
Mm-hmm.
But what I see is when you look at these battles over bread, two things tend to happen when food movements focus so much on individual food choices. Whether they're focusing on trying to get us to eat more industrial white bread or trying to get us to eat no industrial white bread, or trying to get us to eat, you know, local food, whatever. When they focus on trying to change the world through changing individual food choices, even the most well-meaning of us food reformers end up reinforcing social divides between the, you know, the supposedly virtuous us, who knows how to make the right choices about food, and then the pitiful, in need of help, them who can't seem to make the right choices about food. And there's a lot of people out there talking about that now. Let's go help the poor make better choices. But at root, our food problems are about income. And there's all kinds of studies that show that poor people would eat better food if they had more income. Average wages have been stagnant for most people in the United States since the 1970s. Inequality is growing at phenomenal rates. As a food historian, I think that when we look back at our obesity crisis in 40, 50 years, we'll see that we didn't have a problem with uneducated people making the wrong choices about food and needing to be told otherwise, so much as we had a problem with stagnant wages and a highly concentrated food system where a few companies basically get away with setting the terms for how the country eats.
Aaron Bubrow-Strain is the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf.
You can keep your rye, keep your wheat, and pumpernickel. I just will not eat, don't want no seven grain. That I must refuse. That is something that I must refuse.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour may be over, but there's more online. Heard something you want to share with a friend? It's easy at ttbook.org. And while you're feeling social, don't forget to friend us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. CDs are for sale at the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Food and Politics Show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for today's show to Ann Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Executive producer Steve Paulson and technical director Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.